Got good production. You got a story.
Mm-hmm. When Richard Dawkins was asked about the origin of life,
if life exists outside our universe, and if so, have aliens made contact with us?
One time we were fish.
What is the evidence for this?
We're climbing trees.
This is not something based on scientific evidence. This is
in the world of apes, monkeys.
The first person to actually say that Darwinism was a religion.
And here you go. And this is Subhoor here on The Dean Show.
Go ahead and subscribe right now. Hit that notification bell. Help us get our numbers back up. Did you know that many years ago, The Dean Show, when we started 2006, we used to broadcast for many years on the Khalifa Clothing Channel, currently known as Digital Minbar. So we're trying to get our numbers back up because the channel at that time got closed. Then we started the official Dean Show channel. We're trying to get our numbers back up to where they should be. And that's this number here, 855, combined what we currently have, 442. We should be over 1 million subscribers. Help us to get our numbers back to where they should be. With that small setback that we had many years ago, you guys can help us by subscribing right now and hitting that notification bell. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the show. Assalamu alaikum. And don't forget to support us on our Patreon page.
Dean, The Dean Show.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to The Dean Show. I'm Eddie, your host. Subscribe if you haven't already. My next guest, Subhoor Ahmed, is the author of the forthcoming book, A Failed Hypothesis. He is part of the Sapiens Institute team. He is a public speaker, debater, and writer. He focuses on engaging with the new atheism and has also traveled extensively across the globe teaching Muslims how to articulate Islam to non-Muslims. Subhoor specializes in the philosophy of science with a focus on Darwin's theory of evolution. He has debated many prominent atheists over the years, including professors, atheist activists, and internet personalities on the topics of science, God's existence, and Darwinism. He has given talks across North America, Latin America, Australia, Africa. The list goes on. Subhoor has an MA in philosophy from Birkbeck College, University of London. He is currently a PhD candidate specializing in the philosophy of biology. You got to know him a little bit. Now you're going to get to know him a little bit more as we talk about evolution and also this new religion. There's so many man-made religions. Another one's been added to the bunch called scientism. So let's enjoy this week's show with our brother, our guest, Subhoor Ahmed. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, Eddie. How are you doing?
Alhamdulillah, Rabbil Alameen. How are you?
Alhamdulillah. Thank you for inviting me on the show.
Alhamdulillah. So you heard me talk about this new religion. There's so many man-made religions. It seems like there's a new one added to the bunch. Have you heard of it? Scientism?
Yeah, scientism is a very interesting one. As you know, Eddie, that you've been on the internet long enough to know that every couple of years something becomes more popular than others, and you get these new age beliefs, you get all these different types of things. So scientism is one of those things that's always been there in the background, but the last couple of years it's really come to the fore. So scientism is essentially using the cloak of science to push out a religious ideology, a philosophy. So it's using the word science and the language of science and the, if you like, the status of scientists to actually push out something which is nothing to do with science. So we can define it in the following way. It is an excessive belief in the scientific method. And at a popular level, this leads to some very false claims by people who subscribe to scientism. So the thing is, firstly, no one will call themselves a scientism proponent, right? They will not say, I believe in scientism. They'll just say things like, and I'm going to ask you whether you've heard this before, I don't believe in God, I believe in science. There's no scientific proof for that, so I cannot believe it. For anything to be believable, it has to be scientific. Have you ever heard anything like this before?
You hear this a lot, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I've heard this definitely, yes.
That is scientism.
Person, a lot of times, who's, you know, just repeating this is just somebody, a lot of times, who has no idea really what true science is, you know what I mean? Has probably even taken a science class.
Absolutely. I mean, usually what it's like is it's a get out of jail card.
Yeah. Right?
It's like, okay, well, okay, I don't really have a way of responding to you. Okay, so, you know,
give me scientific evidence, like for God, right? So what we need to do is we actually need to break down this worldview, this actual philosophy, this actual religion of scientism. So the first thing to note about these people is that they say for something to be knowledge, it has to have scientific evidence. And if something does not have scientific evidence, therefore it cannot be knowledge, right? And later on in the discussions, they would say things like, well, since there is no scientific evidence for God, there is no God, because they consider the only type of evidence to be scientific evidence. So that's the first claim we're going to break down, inshallah.
So that's what we're going to start with. Okay, go ahead. Let's break that down.
Okay. So we can ask a series of questions to the person. We can ask them, so you've said that you only believe in knowledge if it can be scientifically verified. And the person would obviously mm-hmm. say yes, because that's what they were alluding to earlier. Mm-hmm. You can ask them a series of questions. You can ask them, okay, my friend, do you have a great, 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 going back 50, 60 generations, a grandfather? Do you actually have a grandfather going back 50, 60 generations? What were they going to say?
Yes.
They're going to say yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. And let's just say I was to push it a bit and say, are you sure about that? Are you like certain you have knowledge of this?
No doubt.
They'll say no doubt. No doubt. Exactly. Then I'll say to them, well, can you give me any scientific evidence for the existence of your 50th generation going back grandfather? What scientific evidence is there?
They'll say, I got some pictures of me and grandpa.
Okay, good. Now, the problem there is, if the pictures did exist, how do we know that's actually your grandpa? It could just be your great uncle. It could be some other guy. But going back 50 generations, obviously there were no pictures back then.
Yeah.
So what other sort of evidence could they use?
So they're gonna go ahead and pretty much testifiable as evidence, you know, so that, because it's come down from my mother, my father, my grandfather, etc.
Yeah, exactly. So they're going to say, well, this I know because my mom told me and my dad told me and they were told by their parents that. So going back, this must have happened. There's also something else, right? So that what you just referred to correctly is known as testimony, right? That's a root of knowledge as well, independent of science. So we know history through testimony. How do we know, for example, that Caesar existed or Genghis Khan existed or Napoleon existed, people that we do believe existed? It's not through science. It's actually through testimony. Now, if they're to turn around and say, well, I could somehow find my grandfather's grave and do a DNA test. Well, even if you could find your grandfather's 50 generations going back his particular grave, you haven't done that test right now, but you believe right now that is, your grandfather did exist going back 50 generations. So that's testimonial knowledge. There's also something else that they could respond with. They could say, well, I exist. My father existed. And going back logically, his father must have existed. And going back using logical deduction, my 50th generation grandfather must have existed. That's just pure logic going down. So again, that's another root of knowledge, which is logic, which has nothing to do with science. So far, just by one question, we've got two sources of knowledge which are independent of science. Now I could ask a second question to the person asking.
So wait, go ahead, stop. So yeah, testimony, what was the other one?
Logic.
Logic, yes.
Yeah, so you're using logic to come up with conclusions, right? Mm-hmm. That's got nothing to do with
science.
Okay, so you could ask them another question. You could say to them, okay, do you believe that if you see a child being run over deliberately, that you see that happening, there's an evil person and they run over a child and they kill a child, you see this horrific sight, do you feel that that is evil? Do you feel that that is wrong? What would they say?
They're going to agree, yeah.
They're going to agree, yes. And do you believe that if somebody ran in front and saved the child just before it got hit, that that would be a good thing?
It's a hero, yes.
Okay, so these feelings that you have, these morals that you have, right? How passionate are you about these things?
Very passionate.
Very passionate. In fact, Eddie, human history is a history of people rising up for moral reasons. You know, you have the entire history of humanity. When you break it down, you find that there were moral movements throughout history. Even today, we get massive moral social movements. So someone says, I only believe in something if it can be scientifically demonstrated or verified or proved. Then we could simply say to them, well, that child being saved or that child horrifically being killed, there is no scientific evidence for right and wrong, but you believe in it. And you believe it to be true. So if you're to deny knowledge that does not come through science, you are to deny good and bad and duties, and you're to deny morality and, in fact, civilization. In fact, you are denying what makes us human, right? So far, we have logic, we have testimony, and we have morality, our belief in morals. So just by asking a few questions, we can actually show that scientism is falling apart. Now I'm going to ask another question to the person. I'm going to say to them, do you believe that the world is real? That you and I are talking right now and the world is real?
Yep.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, if this world is real, then what is the scientific evidence that the world is real? There is actually no argument you can make that using science that this world is real. All you could simply say is, well, for science to even work, for anything to even make sense, the world being real is something we axiomatically all accept. We all accept it. It's something for which we don't need to give scientific evidence for, but it's knowledge we all have. So now we have self-evident truths, things that we know to be true, but we don't actually, we can't actually prove those things scientifically. So far we've had, a few roots of knowledge. There's also something else that we could speak about, which is mathematics. We could ask them, you know, A squared plus B squared is C squared, right? You do this in school, you know, you solve all these things. Are those things scientific knowledge? No, those are mathematical knowledge. So using these different types of thought experiments, we can show them that your scientism worldview actually completely falls apart just by asking a few surface level questions.
Mm-hmm. So what's the difference now between scientism and science?
Good. So science is the application of reason to the natural world. It is a way of understanding, explaining, analyzing, making predictions, and so on and so forth. So science is a beautiful thing. We love science. We don't have a problem with science. Science is a method of trying to gain knowledge about the real world. Now, we have no problem with someone that believes in science because we believe in science. When someone takes science and says, no, this root of knowledge is the only root of knowledge, everything else is irrelevant. That is scientism, where they've taken the garb of science and they've actually excessively applied it to other domains of knowledge and tried to monopolize them and said, no, the only type of knowledge is scientific knowledge. So that's the difference between scientism and science.
What are the main claims of scientism?
So we covered their claim about monopolizing knowledge. Mm-hmm. Another thing that we see is that usually the proponents of scientism in the popular culture, and I don't want to get into the academic discussion about scientism and the academic definitions because those are different to what we face in the public. But one of the things that proponents usually, and you get this a lot at colleges, universities, you get this a lot in terms of the internet atheists, is they will make claims of science being certain. Science giving absolute knowledge, you know, that science is there to give you knowledge which is not going to change, which is absolutely certain. And that's a claim that we can actually challenge through, again, asking a few questions. So what we could do about this claim is we could ask them, is it not true that a scientific theory that we have today, we are basing it upon the knowledge that we have gained? So that's something that we all agree about. However, isn't it also true that we haven't got all of the information that's in the world? So tomorrow, we could gain a novel piece of data or a novel observation which could challenge our previous theory. That's a very simple point. You don't have all the knowledge in the world. Tomorrow you can come up with something that you haven't seen before that can contradict your previous theory. This, in the philosophy of science, is known as the problem of induction, that you cannot be certain of a theory that you've come up with today, because tomorrow you can come up with an observation or a piece of data that will contradict your previous theory. So that's the first point that we can make, and it's known as the problem of induction. The second point is underdetermination. Underdetermination. So underdetermination is that using the same data, we can come up with many different types of inferences. We can come up with many different types of ways of looking at the conclusion. So I'll ask you a question on this. Say I give you $5, right? And I tell you to go down to downtown Chicago, and I want you to use up the $5 and to buy apples and oranges. So you have to come back both with apples and oranges, okay? And say the apple costs $1 and the orange costs $1. So both of those items are $1. And I sent you away with this. You have to spend the full $5. And when you come back, I want you to bring apples and oranges, and both of them are $1 each. Okay. Now, what are you going to come back with when you come back from shopping?
Apples and oranges and no money.
Apples and oranges, no money. Exactly. Now, here's the problem, Eddie, right? You could get 3 oranges and 2 apples. That's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can get 4 oranges and 1 apple. So you get the point. There's many different combinations. Using the data that you have to use $5. Using the data is $1 each. And you have to get both apples and oranges. Just those 3 pieces of data, you can come back with a lot of combinations.
Yeah.
Likewise, a theory is inferred from the data, but the data we can use to infer other theories. Okay? This is known as underdetermination. Now, a lot of the time, these people who believe in scientism and are using the garb of scientism, as you rightly pointed out, they probably haven't even done a science class at a graduate level, right? So they'll usually run away by the time you've highlighted just one or two problems. But just for the sake of it, I'll just quickly go over some more. We also have theory ladenness, in which the theory colors the data. We also have a problem of unconceived alternatives, where there are solutions to the data that we have, but we can't think of them because we haven't actually conceived of them. This happened during the time that we can see between Newton and Einstein. And then there's another issue of methodological naturalism and philosophical naturalism. You know, Eddie, even before you get to these points, you usually find that you don't need to go that far.
Yeah.
They realize that they try to hoodwink you and, you know, you're not having it.
It's over.
It's over, basically, yeah.
Yeah. So there's one claim, I think this is the most preposterous, is that science disproves the creator God.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think this is the most ridiculous one.
Yeah. So what you...
Haven't there been... I mean, there are so many scientists, and I want to get into this in a few, that now the institution's been pretty much set up that it's an atheist secular institute, and these secular institutions, atheism is the religion pretty much. And Now all these people who fight for creationism, you know, they've kind of been blacklisted. You know, they're the ones who are not invited to the parties. They're like, it's like they don't even exist.
Yeah.
So, but they're scientists also. They're also academics who went to the same schools.
Absolutely. And look, I think the first point to note here is they're using an argument, and their argument is this: hey, look, guys, look at all these scientists. You know, all of them today, or most of them, or a large percentage of them, they happen to be agnostic or atheist. So therefore, agnosticism or atheism must be coming from science. That's their basic argument, right? And they'll throw out all sorts of statistics, like 90-something percent in the American Association of Scientists or whatever do not believe in a personal God and all this type of stuff. And you find people like Richard Dawkins, who are quite well known, popularizing these arguments in their books. Now, the problem with this argument is, let's just not break down why this argument's wrong. Let's actually use this argument against them. So their argument is, oh, wow, look at all these scientists today, and they all must be, doubt the existence of a personal God. So therefore, we should all basically become atheists. The problem with this argument is, this is a very small snapshot of history. If we actually go back and we look at the entire scientific enterprise over hundreds of years, we will find that the majority of the scientists were theists. They were people who believed in God. So if we're to use this argument for the 19th century, 20th century, 21st century, going back all the way to the 10th century, and if we're to do that, then we would say the vast majority of scientists throughout history were theists. Therefore, we should all become theists. So the problem with the argument is, it can work against them. The second thing is, it's not actually a valid argument. If all the scientists in the world today decided something that they believed in, right? Does that mean that we should all, like sheep, without thinking, start following them? That's not true at all. What we need to understand is that the atheism and agnosticism of today, which generally dominates the scientific domain in terms of the Western world, this has cultural origins more than anything to do with science itself. So we have to understand that this argument is not valid. It works against them. And two, it's trying to invoke this type of sheepish behavior from us. But the fact is, we shouldn't actually fall for those types of arguments. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, that science can do to undermine God's existence. The issue they have is scientism. They say, because there is no scientific evidence of God, therefore there is no God. And we're gonna turn around and say to them, we never said there has to be scientific evidence for God. We can come up with rational arguments for God. The problem with you guys is, you think rationality and science is the same thing, which is the problem of scientism.
Mm-hmm. That takes me back to what you mentioned, a prominent, I would say, because you've extensively studied, debated, and you've got a lot of knowledge in this new atheism. What's the difference, before I ask you my question, atheism, for people that I know, and this, when you put the term new atheism, what's the difference now? Sure. Atheism and new atheism. And then, sure, I'll ask you my question.
Yeah, that's a very good question, actually, because it can get confusing. So atheism is generally a position in which you do not believe there is a God, or you are, you have agnostic atheism as well, where people are kind of like unsure. But it's just a position that somebody holds, that, look, I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist, right? New atheism is actually a social movement, or we can say it was a social movement. It's really dying down now. So this movement was really spearheaded after 9/11. By the likes of Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Daniel Dennett, and Christopher Hitchens, who are known as the Four Horsemen of atheism. And their ideas collectively came out. So you had the God delusion coming out by Richard Dawkins. You had The End of Faith. You had God is Not Great. I forgot Daniel Dennett's book. And all these guys started publishing books. They started doing conferences. They started doing debates. Their view was, okay, we're going to finish religion. You know, we're going to kill religion. We're going to do this. And you can see this in their videos, them openly saying this. And it turned out to be a really flat-footed assumption of theirs, that they could just, you know, swipe away Islam, swipe away Christianity, just swipe away faith from the hearts of people. Because, you know, back in 2006, when they were making these types of noises, we're here in 2021. And what we find is that their movement basically fell apart. It didn't really gain as many followers as they actually wanted to. They even wanted to move into politics, some of them, right? Mm-hmm. Other new atheists started, rallying for these types of Reason Rally in America, and, you know, all this type of stuff. But that's the actual difference, that one is a social contemporary movement, and one is just a position that someone holds.
So is it safe to say these are like the radical atheists, like the ISIS atheists?
Well, the thing which is very interesting, and I'm glad
you get my point. These are the ones who are kind of the extreme atheists.
Well, what we would say is that, when you come up with,
because didn't Sam Harris, wasn't he the one that said I'd blow up Mecca? We should
actually one of the things he wrote about was nuking Mecca. And also what you find amongst them is they openly talk about discriminating against Muslims and doing these types of things.
Yeah.
However, Eddie, I think it's very important to understand that these people, they do not call for violence. So even when Sam Harris says these things, he's saying them as a hypothetical thing. So, you know, they wouldn't be violent themselves or call for violence. But what we do need to understand is they don't have power. Right, they don't actually have power. They just have the ability to write some books and
you know. So they're playing the system. But if they had the power, it'd be a different story.
Well, I wouldn't say if these guys had the power, they would actually be violent. What I would say is, let's look at what happened when atheists did have power.
That's the point. Yeah, when you
the you know, communist Russia, you know, the hundreds of millions of people, not hundreds. What's it called? One of the stats is 100 million people died in the 20th century because of communist,
How many died during the reign of the Bolsheviks?
Yeah, exactly. You get, horrific crimes against religious communities. You get, you know, all these types of destruction of religious property. Innocent people get killed, you know, and we see this in, for example, not only when these communist countries take over, their own regions, but also when they take over Central Asian countries like Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, and all these places.
Because you often hear, the cliche, the argument, the mantra that people are like, "Oh, religions are the cause of all war," right? But I mean, when you get down to the nitty and gritty, I mean, it's actually the people who are godless, who don't believe in a God, because there's no moral compass, so they can do whatever they want. And historically, this is what we see. Even currently, what's happening, modern day Inquisition is happening. What right now with the Uyghur Muslims, right? And that's a communist party that's killing, raping, and the world is like asleep.
Absolutely. And the thing is, when these people say, "Look, we're peaceful atheists, but we're just, you know, intellectually trying to challenge you guys," we would return and say to them, "Well, that's fine, you know, you're peaceful and all of that, you guys, but look at what the people who subscribe to your worldview have done in the past." So you can't say this against the Muslim community: "Oh, Muslims are violent because this thing happened and those people share your faith." And then when it comes to the people who share your faith, because atheism is a faith, that you don't need to answer for them. I mean, we will openly condemn terrorism. We will openly condemn extremism. We'll openly condemn these things. But you guys, you don't even accept that they're part of your flock, when they clearly are. Stalin, Lenin, Chairman Mao, who were these people? They weren't Christians or Muslims or Jewish people. They were militant atheists, and they actually believed and reinforced this throughout their territory, that they wanted to basically replace religion and have themselves and their ideologies as the supreme things. Because if you don't believe in God, if you do not have any belief in God, if you reject the hereafter, and you have ultimate power, you know, in their minds, at least the sort of power that they thought they had, then what's to stop that evil that they have within themselves, right? And that's why you find mass atrocities committed by these atheists in the 20th century.
So you can make a good guess that the people that you mentioned, these are like the modern day prophets for the new atheism, these militant atheists. Now, who follow this new atheism, I mean, you can just take a good guess, like what side would they be on? Where would they kind of like fit in if they had the power?
It's not
a far stretch of the imagination where someone is talking about, you know, "Oh, we should nuke it." But, you know, if they had the power, why wouldn't they press the button?
Well, this is quite interesting, because I think a lot of these people would never want atheists to have that much political power. And, you know, it's very interesting. I've actually been seeing amongst some of these atheists that they see a utility in religion as long as someone else does the believing,
right? Because they know themselves. They know themselves deep down that they would rather be in a society in which you have, you know, you have many different religions, many different systems, many different things going on, than be in a state like communist Russia, or you know, these states which are, you know, where there's only one ideology and they have all this type of power. But I mean, definitely with people like Sam Harris and you know, these like who openly advocate, you know, these types of ideas, one can only guess what's going through their head and what would happen if they actually had power.
Yeah, it's crazy. So let's go back to, because it's intertwined all together, scientism, and then how would you fit in evolution with scientism?
That's a good point.
It, doesn't that kick it off?
Yeah, I mean, it's like once they get the first assumption wrong, once they, you know,
the first assumption wrong, yes,
once they step into the arena with the wrong lens, then everything else starts messing up. So if they go into evolutionary theory with the idea that science is the only root of knowledge, with the idea that science is certain, and with the idea that science undermines God, which are the three main claims that you hear these popularizers talk about, then you'll come up with really absurd conclusions. So one of the things that these guys do is they say evolutionary theory undermines, Darwinian theory undermines the existence of God. It does away with God's existence. There is no need for God's existence. Now, this is one of the most popular ideas out there, that somehow Darwin came along and he absolutely destroyed intellectually any idea of there being a divine being. Now, what's interesting about this is, although you find people like Richard Dawkins, Lawrence Krauss, and all these people saying this, they themselves, deep down, know this is not the case. Darwin was never an atheist. This is something very interesting.
Hold on. See, this is, a lot of people don't know this. I mean, this is something that is just, for someone listening to you right now, please repeat that.
Yeah. So Darwin was never an atheist. In fact, Darwin did not like his theory being used to buttress atheism. In fact, he said, in my wildest fluctuations, I was never an atheist. When he published his book in 1859, he was what we would call a deist, according to his own words, a deist. A deist is somebody who believes in God, but does not believe in religion. So when he published The Origin of Species, he believed in God. Prior to that, some decades back, he was a Christian. Near the end of his life, he became an agnostic because of the problem of evil and suffering. Now, what they do is they only take what fits their narrative. So when Darwin openly says that, you know, someone can be a theist and believe in his theory, they'll ignore that part. But what they will do is, when Darwin is, for example, being attacked by, like he was attacked by some Christians when he was alive, they would use that and say, look, they were suppressing him and, you know, he was being mocked and this and that. So they try and create this false dichotomy. It was Darwin versus theism, Darwin versus God. When Darwin was a lot more sophisticated in his thinking, and he was a lot more respectful to the belief in God, and a lot more respectful, in fact, to Christianity as well.
Most people don't know, they hear the term evolution, they ascribe that it's scientific, it's golden, this is the new discoveries, we're in the modern day. So I want to share this video with you, and let's just kind of, you know, look through it real quickly and then get your thoughts on it. See, notice one thing I want to show. You got good production, you got a story, and you got a lot of funds. So I kind of go through this quickly. You're familiar, you're a biologist, you're familiar with all these, right? Okay, keep going. So one time we were fish. This is the evolution process they're explaining, correct?
Yep.
Okay. So now we're about to take a big jump now. Now we're out of the water and we're climbing trees. Now we're in the world of the apes, monkeys. And here you go. And this is Subhur here on the Dean Show. Okay. Is that pretty accurate? That's like the mainstream?
Yeah, I mean, this is the traditional view of the tree of life and how life evolved and stuff. However, I just want to point out some things. Just within the few seconds of the opening, there's a huge statement that was there with absolutely no evidence today, right? So what they'll say is, okay, so in the beginning, there was the cell, right? There was the cell. And that cell came from primordial soup or whatever, right? You have all these different ideas that they have. Now, they call this abiogenesis. They call this from non-life to life, right? Now, we need to simply ask them, what is the evidence for this? And just by that question, you will rattle them. You will actually
Repeat the question.
You can simply ask them, what is the evidence for abiogenesis? What is the evidence that life came from non-life? And also, what is the evidence that there was one origin of life, that there was one self-replicating molecule, cell, whatever? Just ask them this question and see what their response is. Because, you know, you can get into all sorts of deep technical analysis of all of these models that they have. A great scientist to look at this is Dr. James Torr. He blows out of the water all of these, pathetic claims that they've worked out abiogenesis. They worked out how life came from non-life. But you can simply ask them, okay, so you just made this claim and this supposedly happened 4 billion years ago. Can you explain to us what's the evidence for this? So and you'd be very surprised if they even give you an answer.
Yeah, that's deep. I mean, so that goes back to, is it belief or is it fact? Because you have to take a big leap of faith, what they usually again attribute to religion and God. So is it synonymous what you're saying as if you're asking for observable, testable evidence?
Yeah. So, I think this is where it's very important for us to talk about. It is way more than just a scientific claim. They have faith in this. This is, if you like, the atheist Genesis story. This is their origin story. They have absolutely no evidence that there was one cell, right? And 4 billion years ago, these things happened. But since they believe there is no God, then they have to come up with some sort of story. And that is the story that they actually come up with. Now, I have respect for those evolutionary biologists and those philosophers who openly speak up and criticize these issues. So what we'll find is that, and here I'm going to speak about atheists and agnostics. I'm not talking about Christians or Muslims or Jewish people or anybody with some sort of belief in religion. So we have people like the atheist philosopher Thomas Nagel, who wrote the book Mind and Cosmos, which is published by Oxford University. And he mentions this. He actually mentions that, the idea that life came from non-life and all of this naturalistically evolved, this is not something based on scientific evidence. This is some a paradigm which they have, and it's just, difficult to actually question. And anybody that tries to question it is actually, ridiculed. Then you get people like Jerry Fodor, who, when he tried to question Darwinism, he was called a secular creationist. They couldn't call him a creationist because he was an atheist. Then you get people like James Shapiro, Masao Tashinai, Lynn Margulis. You get these biologists who openly say that, Darwinian evolution is essentially a religion. Right. In fact, Lynn Margulis says something very interesting. She was the late wife of Carl Sagan, the famous physicist. Right. So although she was an atheist, she said, history will judge Neo-Darwinism to be an Anglo-Saxon religion.
right? So the problem here is that there is a huge pressure in academia to suppress information which goes against Darwin's theory and the worry about creationism and, you know, these guys coming in. There's a fantastic documentary.
Creationist? What do you say back to them when they say you're a creationist?
Did I hit it? Is that the one?
Yeah.
In an unguided and undesigned way, the theory of evolution.
Excuse me?
Yes, Ben.
How did life begin in the first place?
Mr. Stein, you have the same question every time.
Well, you never answer it, sir.
It develops, you know, we've been through this so many times, you haven't
so... Could there have been an intelligent designer?
Sorry, I cut you off, but did I hit it right? It's like is that the one?
That's the one, and that documentary is amazing.
We didn't plan this. See,
but this is an amazing documentary. What the first person you showed was actually Dr. Jonathan Wells, right? So you find him in there. You find Stephen Meyer. You find Michael Behe, Paul Nelson. And some of these people, alhamdulillah, they've come onto my channel and I've actually interviewed them as well. The fact is that these are people who were academically not given the freedom to express their views because they were coming up with information going against, you know, Darwinian theory, the contemporary ideas that we actually have. So these are guys associated with the intelligent design movement, the movement which is there to not just say, okay, let's just take Darwinian evolution, throw it out, and let's just start teaching religion. No, these are people who are saying, no, let's have a discussion. You can have your Darwinian evolution. We can have our intelligent design hypothesis. Let's have a scientific discussion. And they're being denied that. So, you know, no free and no intelligence allowed is the name of the documentary. And right near the end of the documentary, when it comes to the origin of life, remember I told you, Eddie, they don't really have an answer. Mm-hmm. When Richard Dawkins was asked about the origin of life, he actually said it's possible that life originated from aliens who sent down life on Earth. Right?
I don't know if you've seen, go ahead, finish. That's crazy. I always say that whenever I'm talking about the topic of atheism, I always mention that. They always, and this is the lay person, they come out and they start talking, they won't believe in the creator, but they'll start talking about aliens.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is they'll try and label it in a very fancy way. So for example, the actual term for this is called panspermia. Panspermia. And Francis Crick, the one who discovered the double helix shape of the DNA, he's the one who proposed this idea. He was an atheist and he couldn't explain the complexity of life. So he had this idea that life was sent to Earth via rockets from, you know, extraterrestrials living someplace else. And, you know, when Richard Dawkins was, because, you know, obviously he's a fan of Crick, and when he was asked by the interviewer in this particular documentary near the end that, okay, so if life was sent down by these aliens to Earth, where did the aliens come from? And he said they evolved from Darwinian evolution. So basically, it's just passing on the buck. It's laughable at this point.
But it's crazy. People still keep buying their books. People still keep, you know, still in line to get more of the stories. But like I said, when I showed you this clip as a story, it's good production and it's well funded. Let me get into the clip that's part of the documentary that I wanted to show you.
Well, I usually don't get the opportunity.
What's at stake for you personally here?
First of all, I love science. I think the way Darwinism corrupts the evidence, distorts the evidence, is bad for science.
The other scientists would tell you to just shut up if you love science. Okay. Because you're sort of being a bomb thrower into science.
I am upsetting the apple cart, and I think it deserves to be upset in this case.
Why?
Because the evidence is being distorted to prop up a theory that I think doesn't fit it.
Was Darwinism really that bad? Perhaps a change of scenery would give me a fresh perspective.
So that it could be correct. That's a very different question. One of my prevailing doctrines about Darwinian theory is, man, that thing is just a mess. It's like looking into a room full of smoke. Nothing in the theory is precisely, clearly, carefully defined or delineated. It lacks all of the rigor one expects from mathematical physics, and mathematical physics lacks all the rigor one expects from mathematics. So we're talking about a gradual descent down the level of intelligibility until we reach evolutionary biology. We don't even know what a species is, for heaven's sakes.
So his theory is smoke, but elegant smoke.
There's a certain elegance to it, but, you know, I think Einstein had the appropriate remark. He preferred to leave elegance to his tailor.
A room full of smoke? That certainly wasn't what I was hearing from prominent Darwinists like Richard Dawkins.
Evolution is a fact. It's a fact which is established as securely as essentially any other fact that we have in science.
Richard Dawkins is so confident that evolution is a fact and that therefore God doesn't exist that he has devoted his entire life to spreading the evolution gospel.
I'm an atheist with respect to the Judeo-Christian God because there is not a shred of evidence in favor of the Judeo-Christian God. It is completely right to say that since the evidence for evolution is so absolutely, totally overwhelming, nobody who looks at it could possibly doubt that if they were sane and not stupid. So the only remaining possibility is that they're ignorant, and most people who don't believe in evolution are indeed ignorant.
But the people I spoke with weren't ignorant. They were highly credentialed scientists. So there had to be something else going on here. So you think the whole theory of evolution is false, or just certain parts of it?
Well, again, evolution is a slippery word. I would say minor changes within species happen. But Darwin didn't write a book called how existing species change over time. He wrote a book called The Origin of Species. He purported to show how this same process leads to new species, every species. And the evidence for that grand claim is, in my opinion, almost totally lacking.
How does Darwin or Darwinism say life began?
Well, he didn't know, and in fact, nobody knows. So Darwinism, strictly defined, starts after the origin of life.
From the back to the front, nobody knows, but we know. It's in the Quran. It's there. But we're talking about from the academic circles here. They don't know, but you have, in the beginning, he talks about these scientists are talking about it's like a room of smoke, elegant smoke.
Yeah, I mean, this is where, you know, we can give people a very good solution. We can say to them, look, when you are working within the field of science, when you're at university or any of these things, you can accept any scientific theory, even Darwinian evolution, as a valid scientific theory, paradigm, model, but you don't accept it to be literally true. Because the real issue here, Eddie, is that people don't understand the philosophy of science. And nor do they understand the science itself when it comes to evolutionary theory. They don't understand the alternatives to Darwinian evolution like intelligent design, because intelligent design is not allowed to be taught. In fact, critics of Darwin, who themselves are not even Christian or Muslim or have any faith, they themselves have also been, sidelined. So if a theory is, you know, so robust, then why are they afraid of a bit of criticism? Why are they afraid of actually having a dialogue? Like these guys that you just showed in this documentary, rather than canceling them, wasn't it better to actually bring them into a room, ask them, where's your argument? Where's my argument? Okay, let's have it. And it's a natural selection of ideas until someone wins. But we don't have that. And, it's quite sad.
They want to shut down the debate. I mean,
they have shut down the debate. In academia, if you say intelligent design, like if you try and publish a paper, you cannot. There is no debate in academia on this right now in a significant way because they are canceling people left, right, and center. In fact, people are scared of actually saying that they're planning on writing stuff on this.
Wow, that is deep if you think about it. I mean, this just takes you down to just, you can just go in so many directions here. If you think about this now, we're freedom of speech. We're in America, right? We should be able to talk ideas. Now, I think everyone should watch this documentary. I recommended it also before, Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, because it shows these are academic scientists who believe in a creator. And now they're being silenced. They're being blacklisted. They cannot come out freely and talk about this.
Yeah.
Why? because it goes against what? The religion of secularism?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something very important, and I think this is a good point to wrap up this whole segment on.
And let me just add one more thing, and sure. This is what this is what the Muslims are getting, and Christians and everyone, they're getting exposed to. They're getting, and this religion is pushed on you now. Scientism, evolution, this whole, yeah. Again, not denying evolution, you can go ahead and you know, the parts that the difference between micro and macro and whatnot, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, look, generally the idea of evolution was known before Darwin. So we're not talking about the general observation of evolution. We're talking about Darwin's particular claims about...
Could you call it adaptation?
Yeah, I mean, you could call it adaptation, but the real issue here is Darwin's twin claims of universal common ancestry and all of this happening naturally, right? Without, neo-Darwinism today, which obviously moved away from Darwin, becoming a lot more militantly atheistic, you know, how, as Richard Dawkins calls it, the blind watchmaker, you know, there is no God. Mm-hmm. So that's the real issue here. Now, what's very interesting is we are not the people, Muslims or Christians or people of faith, we are not the people who said Darwinian evolution is a religion. We're not. The first person to actually say that Darwinism was a religion, that evolutionary humanism is a religion, is actually a Darwinist. So Julian Huxley was a very important figure in the early 20th century. He was somebody who was a philosopher, an atheist philosopher, a biologist. He contributed significantly to neo-Darwinism, the contemporary theory that we actually have. And he believed that Darwinism, what he termed evolutionary humanism, he believed it was a religion. He actually called it a religion. Wow. Now, he's written a book in the 1930s, I believe, or early 40s, and it's called Religion Without Revelation. Religion, you can Google it right now. The book is called Religion Without Revelation.
Without Revelation.
In this book, that Religion Without Revelation is evolutionary humanism. In his book, New Bottles for New Wine, which I was just reading just 2 days ago, again, he makes claims about, you know, Darwinian evolution. You can see for him, it's something way more than just that. And I just want to highlight something about Julian Huxley. Julian Huxley believed that in the same way today, in his time in the 40s, nobody believed that the earth, everyone accepted that the earth was not flat, right? Everyone accepted that, that the flat theory was wrong. He said in the same way, in the future, no one will believe in God. And he believed that evolutionary humanism should be evangelized to the entire world. He actually believed this. Now, he wasn't just a lone wolf. He went on, and Eddie, this is really going to send some shivers up your spine. He went on to become the founding father of UNESCO, the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. UNESCO's first guy was Julian Huxley. You can go and Google this. Wow. And UNESCO has an influence in terms of the entire world. So we need to understand, this guy was an ideologue. He believed that this new religion needed to be evangelized. And he had this very important political position. Now, in 2016, the most well-known Darwinian author in the world, the most well-known Darwinian academic in the world, the atheist philosopher Michael Ruse, he wrote a book. And this book, I just want you to just understand the significance of this book. This book was called Darwinism as Religion. Darwinism as Religion. And this was published by none other than Oxford University, right? So you have an atheist philosopher publishing a book by Oxford University. How much more credible can we get from their camp, right? And he's far more greater in status than people like Richard Dawkins in the field of Darwinian evolution. Now, in that book, he basically argues from the onset till today, Darwinian evolution may be a scientific theory, but it has been more than that. It has been a perspective beyond just a scientific theory. It has been a religion, right? So what I want people to understand especially people who disagree with us, is we're not the ones saying that Darwinian evolution is a religion. This is your guys. And it's your ideologues who've been behind this sociological movement to try and evangelize the world towards a Darwinian perspective.
And that goes back to what I was trying to say, was now you're going into a university, and if you're not equipped knowing these things, and now you see the professor and he's following his prophet, who's Richard Dawkins, and now this is someone who is spewing beautiful, you know, what you perceive as, you know, beautiful rhetoric, and you're like, wow, you're just amazed at the words he's using, and you're not well grounded in your dean, first of all, and you don't know many of these things that you just uncovered. This is so important that you know these things. You know, that a lot of this stuff that they go ahead and teach, this stuff is baseless. It's not on evidence. Like you said, you know, this is a story. It's funded very well. And then you end up, you know, leaving your dean because of this.
Absolutely. And I would add to that, Eddie, that you have some very good professors as well. You have some people who are, although they're atheists, although they are Darwinists themselves, they would not be ideologically driven in the same way people like Richard Dawkins are. On YouTube, you will find a talk between myself and a professor at the University of Birmingham, Professor Jeremy Pritchard, who is a specialist in his field. And we go over this, right? Even though he's in a different camp, he's an atheist and I'm a Muslim, and we're not going to agree on everything. That discussion we had is called, does evolution undermine God? And he agreed that it doesn't. And you get professors like this who are open, who say, no, you know, this is not true. You know, this isn't something that undermines belief in God. And it is much more complex than that, much more sophisticated than that, much more nuanced than that. But it's people like Richard Dawkins who wants this war in the classroom between believers and atheists. And he wants to make it look like you have to be one or the other, and you have to be at each other's throats, when we're actually trying to give a much more academic type of discourse here.
Yeah.
So if anybody's interested, they can go watch that talk as well.
As we wrap up now, just a couple more points. I want to ask a couple more questions. So really at the end, it's not, the bottom line is not truth in these academic settings. It's the bottom line is not, it should be ultimately, if it's science and you're following science and you want to get to the truth of the matter. But at the end of the day, if you watch this documentary, it's like, okay, everything else can possibly, you know, we can entertain it, you know, the piggybacking of on the crystals, you know, that theory, we can entertain this. But as soon as it comes to intelligent design, no. Even if that's the truth, we won't accept that.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. And what we need to do especially as Muslims, is you can have a large part of the world believing something, and we know this as Muslims, but that doesn't mean that it's true. So you can have a large part of the world, which right after 9/11 believed Islam was a certain type of ideology, but all those ideas were wrong. All of those, you know, people churning out those things, they were all wrong. So just because a lot of people are saying the same thing, sometimes even we as Muslims, we think, man, I don't want to be like the black sheep, you know, sticking out in a crowd. I want to be, you know, I just want to be with, you know, with everybody. I want to conform. But actually, Darwin himself stood out. He was like, no, this is, you know, like he didn't agree with the people of his time. So he came up with his own theory. So there's nothing wrong with being that black sheep. There's nothing wrong with standing up and saying, no, you know, we are going to stand up to this. We're going to, I mean, look at it from this perspective. Racism, say, 60 years ago was completely acceptable, right? In places like America. Then you had, you know, Rosa Parks. You had these people who stood up and said, no, we're not going to accept this. And you find this in other parts of the world. You find this in indigenous communities, which are standing up to, say, their Spanish occupiers. You get this in the Indian subcontinent as well. So, you know, we shouldn't be shy of going against the grain. We shouldn't be shy as Muslims, as believers, as people who believe that we are upon the truth, of going against something that may be very popular in society. It shouldn't upset us, right? It shouldn't scare us. We should actually be at the forefront of this. And what I would say is credit is due to the intelligent design guys, and obviously women as well who are involved, that they've stuck to their guns. You know, they've really had this onslaught from all across the atheist world, and they've managed to stick in there.
Yeah, and it surprised me. Who was this person again? This is that you said he claimed this term, that this evolution is actually a religion, and to go ahead and spread this all over the world.
And it's Julian Huxley.
That had me thinking, like, what at the end are you spreading? Like, what moral code, what moral compass, what are you giving to the world? What do you have to offer at the end? You know, and then contrast that with when we talk about, you know, Islam, for instance, submission to the creator, not the creation. You're talking about spreading justice in the world, ending injustice. You're talking about ending hunger, feeding all of humanity. You're talking about free healthcare. You're talking about everything that's good out there. You know, you're talking about spreading peace. Peace acquired by submitting your will to God, to the creator. I mean, everything good, pure, this is what we're talking about giving to the world. What are they talking about spreading at the end of the day?
And you've raised a very good point. So I just want to remind everybody of something very important in terms of the history of Darwinism. After Darwin's death, in fact, while he was alive, this movement started that is known today as social Darwinism. Now, social Darwinism is essentially the ideas of Darwin applied to society. Now, today, this is ridiculed as a pseudoscience and no one takes it seriously. However, at the time, this was the good stuff. This was the stuff that was being pumped out of even some universities. The Nazis took it to another level and they started exterminating the weaker segments of their society and, you know, people that they saw as, you know, racially inferior. So, you know, social Darwinists, they would see the strong capitalists surviving and the weaker ones, you know, us not having a duty towards them, eugenics, you know, all this stuff. This is historically true.
It's survival of the fittest.
In fact, today, right now, if you walk past a hospital, that is the survival of the unfittest, and you're paying for it with your tax dollars. That goes against Darwinian theory. Human behavior goes against Darwin's theory. So, you know, it's so important that we need to understand ideas like the selfish gene. You know, they promoted this type of capitalist culture. We can't deny these things. Now, obviously, there's some evolutionary thinkers today who are saying, oh, that's got nothing to do with us. That's fine. But historically, we know these things happen. And like you said, Islam is there to teach you. You know, I'll tell you something funny, Eddie, right? Why are people kind to each other if it's survival of the fittest? They don't have an answer. So they think, oh, the reason why you're nice is because you expect something back, which they call reciprocal altruism. Or you're nice to somebody because they're related to you because they hold your genes. They call that kin selection. We as Muslims say we're nice to people because we deep down are nice because we have a fitrah. We believe in God, right? In fact, human beings generally, right, we have a lot of good within us. We have that good which Islam is trying to amplify, right? That's a much more beautiful idea of human nature than the selfish gene or social Darwinism or sociobiology, all this stuff that they try and color us with.
All right, go ahead and leave us with something. Purpose. That's the theme of the Dean Show, trying to get people to reflect, to think about their purpose, why they've been created, why are they here in this life, and where are they going when they die? So leave us with something that you can have the university student, the person who follows scientism, and now he's questioning it. Leave us with something to have people, the light bulb go on, and to have them think more about what is the true purpose of life. What do you leave them with?
Absolutely. I mean, I would contrast two different perspectives. So one perspective is that we are created to worship God. What is worship? Worship is that we have love, hope, fear in the Creator. And everything we do for God alone. We call upon God alone. We make our lives not just a life in which you need to work 9 to 5 and provide for your family and go out with your friends and do these things, but actually there's a higher purpose of life, having that spiritual connection with God, having that connection with other human beings and being good to them for the sake of God. You know, all of these altruistic higher ethics that Islam teaches, this is the purpose of life. And what does Islam essentially teach? Nothing is greater than the remembrance of God. So in this life, as Eddie, we know through your story, right? And we know through the stories of countless people, you know, alive today, that, you know, you can have everything this dunya has to offer, but you will not have peace. Ultimate peace comes through the submission of the Creator. Now let's contrast this beautiful perspective with what Richard Dawkins says in The Selfish Gene. He says the ultimate rationale of life is survival and reproduction. So the fact is, Islam is there to elevate you. And from the other perspective, how different are you from a cow? Like, honestly, in fact, from our perspective, cows worship Allah. But from their perspective, if it's survival and reproduction, you might as well just go to the field. Like, honestly, no other way I could put it.
We got this has to be mandatory watching for anyone in university, about to go to university. They need to watch this episode. It's a very, very important episode. And inshallah, God willing, this can help save some people who might end up, you know, falling for the trap of shaitan, you know, who's setting these traps and misguiding people. So inshallah, this can be of great benefit. And thank you so much for spending the time. I can go on and on. I really enjoyed talking with you. It was a pleasure.
Always a pleasure with you, Eddie.
Inshallah, we can do it again sometime soon.
Inshallah.
May Allah bless you. Jazakallah khair. Thank you so much. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.